KALW.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. The Stud is a gay bar and drag and burlesque performance space, and in 2016, it turned 50. But it was also in the news that year for other reasons.
The Stud is in danger of losing its home in the South of Market neighborhood.
A massive rent increase could force the bar to close at the end of the summer.
The rent will increase from $3,800 a month to $9,500.
The owner says a developer bought the building.
The owner of the Stud says it's time for him to sell the business.
To keep the space alive, the Stud has gone through a number of changes since then. The biggest one involves how the bar is run. KALW's Gabe Graben peeked behind the glittering curtain to learn the story of the Stud Collective.
For over 50 years, the Stud has been our place of solidarity and empowerment, a place for creativity, a gathering spot for queers in the gayest city in America, and a beacon to tourists, travelers, and transplants.
On November 26, 2016, Honey Mahogany stood before a meeting of San Francisco's Small Business Commission. She was speaking on behalf of a group of friends and patrons of the Stud, who called themselves the Stud Collective. They were fighting to keep the bar open, and the goal that day was inclusion in San Francisco's legacy business registry. So Honey described its legacy.
The Stud opened its doors on May 27, 1966. At the time, many of SoMa's bars catered specifically to men in the gay leather scene, but the Stud stood out as a place for patrons of all stripes.
If the Stud got legacy status, the bar would qualify for a rent subsidy from the city. That would help offset the nearly $6,000 rent hike. So there was a lot riding on this speech.
It's a place where everyone can dance, anyone can get on stage to perform, and we all get a chance at finding love. Thank you.
Awesome. Great speech.
Honey's plea clearly moved the committee.
Commissioner Adams.
Yes.
Commissioner Dooley.
Yes.
Commissioner Dwight.
Yes, of course.
Commissioner Ortiz Cartagena.
It yes. was unanimous.
Commissioner Tour Sarkisian.
Yes.
Welcome to the Legacy Business Registry.
Now, you might think that becoming a legacy business would protect the Stud from becoming a former business. And in an ideal world, that would be the case. But this isn't an ideal world. It's San Francisco in a time of rampant gentrification.
We formed the Stud Collective. We are currently 16 members, 15 members strong.
Just days later, Honey Mahogany was giving another speech, this time from the stage of the Stud.
We have a shared vision, and our shared vision is to keep San Francisco queer. That is our...
Honey was joined on stage in front of the iconic gold Mylar curtain by fellow drag queen Vivienne Forevermore, aka artist Micah Sigourney. Micah explained how they got to this point. 6 months earlier, the owner of the Stud had announced that, barring a miracle, the bar would close.
Some of us were at that meeting, got together, and we were like, what the f*** are we going to do now? This is our home. This is where we get to live out our dreams. And we looked around at the resources that we have, and we were broke. But we realized that we were really wealthy and friends.
And that's when Vivi looked at me and she goes, so, honey, you want to buy a bar?
Yeah, basically that's it.
Literally.
The goal? To keep the bar and performance space they love going. And in order to do that, Micah says, they had to move quickly.
We were tapping everyone we knew who had a cultural stake in the Stud or an emotional stake in the Stud, who might also have the time, energy, passion, and like capital.
That pesky capital. None of the Save the Stud crew had enough of it to buy a bar, at least not by themselves. So the group turned to a less traditional model.
The best way was actually through a cooperative.
For one thing, a cooperative would allow them to pool their financial resources and buy the business together. But there were also philosophical reasons.
A cooperative is a business model that has multiple bottom lines, and one of those things is prioritizing the people as opposed to just the profits. And that was really in alignment with what the Stud was to us.
So, what exactly is a worker co-op? And how does it differ from a quote-unquote normal business? Melissa Hoover is executive director of the Democracy at Work Institute. They advocate for worker co-ops and help guide people who want to form them. She says the two business types are not all that different from each other.
A co-op shares about 80% of its DNA with a conventional small business. They both operate in the market, but the real difference is that the cooperative is owned by its members and it's intended to benefit those members.
small variations can have big consequences. For instance, two other things that share 80% of their DNA, people and cows. And what makes co-ops really distinct is that members are simultaneously worker and owner, which is a different animal than just being one or the other.
And as a member, you have a couple rights. The first right is to share in the profits, and the second right is to have a voice in how the business is run.
Instead of existing to enrich a boss or a group of shareholders, worker co-ops can be successful just by providing good jobs and living wages to their members. In some cases, breaking even can be enough. And if co-op members choose not to maximize profits, they can decide to pursue other goals, like taking creative risks or sticking to ethical standards. And if there is a profit, they vote on what to do with it. What may seem like a utopian idea has been hugely successful for some of the Bay Area's most enduring businesses, including Arizmendi Bakery, The Cheese Board, and Rainbow Grocery. These food retailers have been in business as co-ops for decades. But would this work for a service business like a bar? How could the Stud Collective make this model work for them?
It was more of a, like, how can't we? And for me, throughout, I would say to myself and to others, like, we do this until we can't do it anymore. So, like, if we hit a point in 2 weeks where this is impossible, then we don't do it. Like, let's just do it until we can't do it. And then we did it till we bought the bar.
Rachel Ryan, a community organizer and sometime go-go dancer, was one of the first to join.
I was amazed how many people right off the bat said, yes, I am in.
People like Paul Dillinger, a vice president at Levi's, who says every community needs places like the Stud.
The Center for Public Convening in straight culture has always been there. It has been the church or the city square. Cultural and public convening for gay culture has always been hidden in a shadowy corner, and that's not fair. And this is one of our public squares. This is, for lack of a better analogy, this is a church.
John Cartwright, who works at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, got involved because the bar made San Francisco feel like home.
When I first came here to San Francisco, like, and the first time I came to this bar was kind of like, oh, okay, it like clicked. I was like, oh, this is where the people are that I want to come and hang out with.
And Bernadette Fons, a Stud bartender who customers know as Bernie, was the only former employee of the Stud to become an owner.
And I, you know, was approached by co-op members if I indeed wanted to be a part of it. And I said, definitely, no hesitation. And I feel that it definitely can survive the challenges of San Francisco business. I don't feel that there's a hurdle that we can't overcome. And I know, again, that sounds Pollyanna-ish, but I do believe that's true.
Yeah, this is San Francisco. We don't need no more f***ing boutiques selling succulents into an orchestra.
And there were plenty of hurdles to come. First of all, they owned the business, but they didn't own the building. And their lease was about to expire. But with the help of District Supervisor Jane Kim, they negotiated a new 2-year lease at a more reasonable rate. Then, they had to learn how to run a bar while also starting a co-op. And that's when things got a lot less exciting.
So did everybody get the agenda or know where to find it under the Google Drive?
They began having regular meetings, which Micah says were run according to strict rules.
Can we have somebody take notes?
One of our first meetings was intro to Robert's Rules of Order. It was a really intense meeting because we all had to get our minds around, like, parliamentary practice. You can't often reply directly. You have to, like, wait your turn. But it's a way of running meetings so that you don't murder each other.
Using this process, the group got clear on what was important to them.
Is it about making $1 million a year, or is it about taking some risks with events from new producers who need the experience? You know, things like this. Like, if we're able to stay open, then we're able to meet these other bottom lines.
And that led to this mission statement.
Nightlife must remain at the heart of San Francisco queer culture. We celebrate and preserve the legacy of the Stud Bar while cultivating creativity and operating ethically and according to our established co-op values: self-help, self-responsibility, democracy, equality, solidarity, and equity. We are committed to a sustainable, radically reimagined business model that leverages the collective energy of a highly engaged ownership community. We have a commitment to diversity in our membership and programming through which we create an inclusive space.
Oh, it still gives me chills.
I know, I love it. It makes me so happy.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The collective was made up of people with both a deep commitment to keeping the stud open and enough money for the buy-in, which created a group that was very invested in running a bar, but without much experience actually doing so. Although Tara Haywood had worked in bars before, she had never done what she needed to do at the stud.
I became the head of the finance department when we first started with absolutely zero finance experience.
It's been hilarious, the things that we've had to just really step up and figure out. I mean, I'm the ATM technician now.
Rachel's basically a plumber now, too, so if you...
If there's some anal beads in your sink that you can't get out, just call Rachel.
That's a real story.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Rachel?
I came in strapped on a headlamp and improvised a tool to go try to plunge the sink in the bathroom and found anal beads in the sink. A little bit of wig hair and some anal beads. There are definitely moments where we bring an issue to the General Assembly in our membership meetings and say, hey, this is outside of my wheelhouse. So if a YouTube tutorial can't do it, the first place I'm going to take that issue is to our membership and say, hey, we've got a hole in the floor. Who can help me patch this?
There were also basic tasks like serving good drinks quickly.
We had great marketing skills, and we had someone who's going to be really good with City Hall. But we didn't have a lot of great barkeep capabilities.
So Paul Dillinger says the group decided to hire bartenders. In doing so, they created a second category of worker, employees who were not co-owners.
The goal would have been that every hour worked here would be worked by someone who owns this place. For that, we would have needed to be recruiting into membership people who clean or people who work security. And it just wasn't possible necessarily to find someone who, with the spirit of this community and the urgency of protecting the co-op, to go out and find the people who also, had the money for the buy-in and had the skills necessary to fully staff a whole work week of work. So we ended up sort of coming to a middle ground, right? And so we have, people do what they can. And I mean, I do what I can, but what I can't do is really be an engaged security guard in an evening when I have to get up in the morning at 8 a.m.
Because remember, Paul's a VP at Levi's. And most of the members have other jobs. While the idea of having employees that aren't co-op members goes against the textbook definition of a worker co-op, Melissa Hoover says it's actually not unusual.
Most worker cooperatives have some percentage of employees who are not owners. That may be because they're on the track to becoming owners. It may be because they don't want to be owners. The key differentiator for a worker co-op is that you have to make membership available to all employees. What we want to avoid in cooperatives is creating like a two-tiered system in which the member owners have, all of the rights and protections and privileges of membership, and then there's a second class of employees who don't have access to that.
Paul says they're working on creating a path to membership for all employees once the business is on solid financial ground, but they're not there yet. Another original intention that the group decided to amend in the interest of keeping the bar running was having a workplace without hierarchy. Instead, managers oversee different departments. Micah says it just worked better that way. It
turned out to be a more troubling way to work, to have much more horizontal structure. Troubling in that it was like inefficient. It wasn't as profitable, which we need in order to provide a space.
Several members, including bar manager Tara Haywood, pointed out that running a bar collectively doesn't mean you have a meeting and a vote about how to cut limes. Reaching consensus on all the tiny decisions would be crazy.
That just wasn't a good idea. It didn't end up working financially for us, organizationally. It was just too much time to bring things back to the big group to make decisions, and it's worked a lot better to have managers.
So, the stud has managers and non-member employees and hierarchy. Though its website proclaims it's the first worker-owned cooperative nightclub in the U.S., they aren't legally registered as a worker co-op in California. But, as Melissa Hoover points out,
there isn't like a ministry of co-ops that's enforcing these things. There's a pretty wide variation of practice in how worker cooperatives work.
Tara says because of the way the business is structured, it's fundamentally different from other bars.
Having worked at other bars and restaurants, when the owner comes in, it's like usually kind of a scary thing. And I I don't think that we agree with having that type of environment.
Melissa Hoover again.
One thing we hear from worker owners a lot is that they feel like they can bring their full selves to work. One of the people who responded to a recent survey we did said, I don't feel like I have to go home and undo all the damage I did during the day, that I can actually live my full self at work.
Hollywood, Texas, who tends bar at the Stud as a non-member employee, agrees.
Being in a queer community, it's really important to some of us to be able to work next to each other instead of work for each other.
And co-op members like Mike DeSigourney feel that difference in everything they do.
I haven't worked a square job for about 8 years, but like I work at this business all the time. And it's tiring and exhausting. And then we have a meeting once a month, which is also tiring and exhausting. But there is something to be said for like washing a glass and being like, we're building this for you, for like the patrons. It isn't just to like make my wage or get a tip. It's not so that one person who maybe lives in Palm Springs is making a ton of profit. It's so that this space continues.
Hi everyone, welcome to Drag Alive.
Continuing, that's been the goal from the beginning. And 2 years after the Stud Collective bought the business, according to Paul Dillinger, it's experienced a renaissance.
You know, we went from a sleepy little club that was maybe busy twice a week and open maybe three times a week to a place that's got diverse and exciting programming 6 nights a week. We've seen extraordinary attendance.
This song is for like you all and for the night and for the stuff. Mark, can I have a spotlight? Yeah, bitch.
In the time since they bought the bar, the Stud Collective has added new shows, new drinks, fancy new curtains on the photo booth, and a palpable renewal of purpose, born of having nearly lost the space. But, as they've known since the beginning, the bar needs to find what they call a forever home. Because for all the changes they've made, the obstacles they face are still the same. This is not a surprise to Melissa Hoover.
The Stud is perfect example of so many of the pressures facing legacy businesses. Employee ownership does not solve that rent pressure. If the rent tripled, the rent tripled.
That pressure nearly closed the bar 2 years ago. So far, the Stud has avoided that outcome, but there's a difference between resisting a threat and becoming immune to it. The Stud's Achilles heel is that they can't really control their own destiny while somebody else owns the land on which they dance. But changing that in the current real estate environment is not easy.
What we're seeing in Soma is what we're seeing in cities around the country, which is that land becomes very valuable. Developers can affect and control policy. Industrial areas that had these sort of funky mixed use kind of character where it was cheap enough to start a bar that was outside the mainstream are suddenly incredibly valuable. And those funky little institutions are being bulldozed for high-end housing that is often, you know, has absentee owners. So we're seeing the sort of hollowing out of neighborhoods that used to be vibrant spaces of commerce and culture.
Although she advocates for businesses to transition to a co-op model, she's also quick to point out that becoming one won't magically save a business that's overburdened with existing financial pressures. Stud manager Tara Haywood can testify to that.
It's not enough that we're a legacy business, that, you know, we're members of the community who participate in all different areas that benefit the neighborhood directly and the greater city. None of that has still been enough to find us a place that will work for us yet, and that can be disheartening.
Rachel Ryan, also a manager, feels that pressure too.
You know, one of the reasons the Stud was at risk of closing was that the owner was like, geez, I don't have it in me to keep fighting this fight. For me, that's been one of the hardest things, is just as lofty as our ideals are and as exciting as it is to be part of this radical model, there is still that financial bottom line that we need to meet, and we need to hustle every day to do it.
And so that's what they're doing. And they're not giving up.
What you can do is keep showing up so that we can keep showing up. It takes money to run a business, and it's your money that keeps this place open so you can come here and party.
And you can, for at least another 2 years, because the collective recently signed an extension to their lease. On a Friday night, a week before Pride 2019, the Stud is packed. And for everyone here, just being together in this space is reason to celebrate.
We all love you. If you want some photos, make your way towards the stage. We'll make it happen. DJ, please put on some music.
In Soma, I'm Gabe Graben for Cross Currents.
Thanks to Jen Chien and Meredith Hoddenott, who conducted some of the interviews in that story. The Stud will be hosting a full slate of performances and parties throughout Pride Weekend. That's June 29th and 30th. They'll be open until 4 a.m. down at 9th and Harrison. Check out our website at kalw.org for all the details. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get all our interviews and shows right in your inbox.